The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Johnson, Judge Wheelock, Judge John Smith, the Honorable Matthew Johnson presiding.
Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. This panel of the court today is hearing oral arguments by video conference using the Zoom format. The panel has four cases on its oral argument calendar. The first one, I will call the first case now. The first case is A24-518, Summer Rae Cotta on behalf of minor children versus Brian Gerald Cotta. Counsel, are just so you know, our procedures are equivalent to what they are in the courtroom. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your principal arguments. Appellant's counsel will then have 5 minutes for rebuttal. If you're using the gallery view or some other mode, you should see the time clock on your screen, which will count backwards, so you will be aware of how much time you have remaining in your arguments. With that, I think we are ready to begin. Counsel for appellant, you may identify yourself and your client and then begin your argument.
Good morning, Your Honor. Thank you. Thomas Braun, BRAUN, on behalf of Appellant Summer Cotta. May it please the court, counsel. This matter is before the Court of Appeals following a seven-day evidentiary hearing involving an order for protection that was brought on behalf of eight of the party's minor children. The testimony in this case and the record is extensive, as the court, I'm sure, is aware after reviewing the evidentiary hearing. A number of individuals testified about the actions in the home that involved the respondent, Brian Cotta, and his discipline or purported discipline of the minor children within the home. This matter was initiated after the children had a well child visit at a clinic in Winona, and Dr. Lalemon noticed bruising on the youngest child's buttocks. Hudson made a report to social services. Social services, by way of Aubrey Bauer, got involved and interviewed the minor children.
Mr. Braun, I just want to interrupt just to urge you to not disclose the given names of minor children. If you can find a way to make your argument without doing so, we'd appreciate it.
Of course, Your Honor. Thank you. After the bruising was noticed by Dr. Lalemon, the report was made, investigation occurred, and then social services made a finding of maltreatment against Mr. Cotta. That then precipitated the filing of this order for protection, which Mr. Cotta obviously objected to, and the evidentiary hearing ensued. I think it's really important that the court looks at the totality of the circumstances in reviewing Judge Beitendorf's decision, that the use of this back scratcher was ultimately, the court found, to be reasonable discipline. And the assertion made by Ms. Cotta, and really Dr. Lalemon, Winona County Social Services, and the guardian ad litem, was that using an object to hit minor children that causes bruising is not reasonable discipline. It's domestic abuse. And the court focused on 609.06 when looking at what the definition of reasonable discipline is, and subdivision 6 states that when used by a parent, a guardian, or other lawful custodian of a child in the exercise of lawful authority to restrain or correct such child. So the statute contemplates, you know, an action occurring and then a parent reacting to correct the action on behalf of the child. That is the discipline that is authorized by 609.06. The testimony in this case, though, is that Mr. Cotta inflicted domestic abuse. He used this back scratcher indiscriminately against the children, that he would walk around with it at night. And he would walk around with it because it was the instrumentality of his abuse. He could assert his authority by simply carrying this back scratcher with him because the children were in fear that they're going to be hit with this back scratcher. That is not to restrain or correct behavior. It's to cause fear. And that's exactly what the Order for Protection statute talks about. In 518B.01, the infliction of fear of imminent physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. Here you have very young minor children who frequently, Macy talked about, you know, seeing over, excuse me, Macy's one of the adult children, Macy talked about seeing over 50 hittings or assaults with this back scratcher. The other minor children, when they testified, countless times they were hit with this back scratcher by the respondent.
And Mr. Braun?
Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Judge Wheeler.
I think that I understand that the testimony was that there were, you know, these numerous incidents. The district court, however, determined that no one was able to testify to specific instances. And I think it was that lack of specificity that ultimately, you know, was the basis for the district court's decision here when it applied the statutes. Can you speak to the lack of specificity the district court found here?
I'd be happy to, Your Honor. Thank you. And that is a good point, because the district court really adopted Mr. Knizel's findings in totality, really made no changes apart from one to his proposed findings, just signed them. And that was the theory of their defense, that you can't point to specific instances of misconduct. Well, that's just simply not true, and that's not supported by the record. The youngest minor child, when he endured the discipline that Mr. Cada administered against him, Macy testified that that occurred on his parenting time, the weekend before the child was returned to mom. And that was the bruising that the physician saw when she inspected the youngest child's person. That bruising was also present when Aubrey Bauer, the social worker, observed, you know, that physical bruising. So here we have one instance where we know, you know, the exact date when the abuse took place.
Would you agree that that's the only instance that was specifically identified by any of the individuals that testified?
I think that's accurate. And I think that's, you know, and I think that that is consistent with how the children, you know, dealt with this on a day-to-day basis. I mean, they weren't journaling about it. They weren't noting that this was, you know, aberrant behavior or something outside the norm of just the daily course of conduct by Mr. Cada. This was life in their household where they were. Sorry.
Mr. Braun, yeah. Let me ask this. If we take the exact same facts, except that a back scratcher wasn't used, in other words, let's say bruising was caused by hand, would that make a difference?
I don't think that it really would, Your Honor, because we're still talking about the infliction of, you know, punishment that goes beyond a reasonable level. I think it's even more egregious that he's using an object, and for the court to, you know, condone the use of an object in the discipline of a child, I don't believe that that's consistent with Minnesota case law, nor is it consistent.
But do you condone the use of a hand?
I think that I think 609.06 paren 6 authorizes the use of a hand if it's reasonable and if it's done to restrain or correct behavior. But there's a fine line, right, where you have reasonable and judicious discipline of the child, okay, to going to a level of unreasonable discipline and physical assault. So,
but who has to decide what is reasonable? In this case, isn't it the district court?
It is the district court, and the district court has significant discretion in doing so.
Okay, so how do we overcome that in looking at this case? Because it seems that the findings were that this was essentially reasonable.
Well, I think you have to look at the totality of the evidence. I mean, you have one individual, Mr. Cada, who is purporting that this was reasonable discipline. You have Dr. Lelamon, you have Aubrey Black, you have my client, Ms. Cada, Macy, William. You know, Macy's an adult, and, you know, she has witnessed all of this, you know, physical abuse. They're all saying it goes beyond what is reasonable to restrain or correct behavior. And I think the guardian ad litem's opinion is also significant. The guardian spent time with these minor children, produced a report, testified that he believed that the actions of Mr. Cada went beyond what was reasonable for discipline in these circumstances, and recommended to the court that all of the children have supervised parenting time with Mr. Cada. So essentially, the court had to disregard really 8 witnesses to comport with Mr. Cada's belief that his use of this back scratcher and striking his children, which caused bruising, was reasonable. And
Well, it wasn't the mother, didn't she approve or at least participate in this kind of discipline?
there was testimony at trial that my client had a paddle that was gifted to her at the time of the wedding, and that she initially used it, but then had discontinued using it, for years, and that she was no longer employing the use of corporal punishment with the children, because she saw the fear that the children had, essentially in their father, and described in detail when Mr. Cato would get home, the children would basically kind of run through the house to avoid him because they knew what was likely going to come, which was, the use indiscriminately, not to restrain or correct, of this back scratcher. He would hit them in the arm, hit them in the, the bottom, the legs. The testimony is really clear, and there's corroboration of that. So it's very difficult, I think, for the district court to support its findings when you have photographic evidence, when you have a third party agency making a maltreatment determination. You've got the guardian ad litem saying that this abuse was taking place and it's unreasonable. And yet the district court goes off on its own to say that, well, despite the bruising, despite the children's testimony that they are in fear of their father and their actions, which are showing a consistency of having fear in father's presence, that this is reasonable discipline under the circumstances.
Mr. Braun, am I correct in construing your brief that you're not challenging the district court's credibility determinations?
Yeah, we're not challenging the district court's credibility determinations. That would have to be a clearly erroneous standard, and that's very, very difficult to do.
Well, a lot of the evidence that you're talking about was found to be not credible by the district court, right?
That's correct. And I think that when, which is why our argument is really focused on, the legal analysis behind 609.06 and how that is essentially inconsistent with 518.01, given the evidence presented with the court. You
And
have.
I think that's an interesting argument. I'm sorry to cut you off. I do understand the argument, and I wanted to ask, but so it seems that argument would be more squarely presented to us if the district court had made findings that there was physical harm or bodily injury, but that the provisions in Chapter 609 carve out an exception to the provisions in 518B01. But as I, I'm looking at the district court's order, paragraph 40 says essentially there is no proof of physical harm, no proof of injury. And so, without those favorable findings, I mean, doesn't that get in the way? Doesn't that sort of interrupt your statutory interpretation argument?
Thank you, Your Honor. It's a good question. And I don't think that it does, because the evidence presented at trial, it's clear that there was signs of physical abuse. The photographs that were admitted into evidence of the bruising, the testimony of the social worker, the court's findings are, it just doesn't square up, how that testimony was presented, that evidence was admitted, and yet the court found that wasn't credible or wasn't believable.
Well, that answer sounds like you're saying the district court's findings are clearly erroneous.
Well, I think that really we're more focused on the application of 518.01 paren A paren 1, and that the court, did not clearly square up that issue, did not view that evidence in light of the actual evidence presented at trial, and really how bruising of that nature that the youngest child sustained could be construed as reasonable discipline that was to restrain or correct behavior. We heard testimony from a lot of the minor children about what took place that day when the child was taken into his room, the door was closed. When I say his room, I'm talking about Mr. Cada, and the screaming coming from the room, and the crying, and the strikes that the children were hearing dad administer to this 3-year-old little boy. You know, the court doesn't go into any of that.
I guess I have to ask. I mean, again, this is, I mean, the some of the witnesses supporting petitioner's case, petition, I think the testimony of petitioner herself and the testimony of Child W. I think those two specifically, the district court, those two witnesses, the district court said were not credible. And then there were some witnesses on the other side supporting respondents' case. I'm thinking about the oldest child, who is now an adult woman, and then the non-relative who is formerly a good friend of petitioner. I mean, those witnesses. And I guess more generally, your argument seems to be based on evidence, but not on findings. And then I think a lot of the evidence that you're relying on for your argument was evidence the district court set to the side as not credible. Am I right? And maybe you can be, I'll give you the chance to be more specific or nuanced. You know, what evidence is there that was either accepted by the district court that supports a finding of fact, or that, you know, was not set aside that justifies your statutory argument?
Thank you. And I'll try to be succinct. I think that there
I'll let you give a complete answer to,
Okay.
despite
Thank you very
the
much.
clock counting down. Yeah.
Sure, I appreciate that. So when you look at the case as a whole, when you've got a finding by social services by preponderance of the evidence that maltreatment has occurred, that's really absent from the court's findings, you know, completely. The opinion that from the social worker that the harm from the child that the youngest child inflicted was a result of the conduct of Mr. Cada, and that they investigated other alternative theories and discredited those. You know, the court largely ignored that part of the case, which I think is the strongest part of petitioner's case to support the fact that there was domestic abuse with respect to the youngest child. And I think that that lends significant credibility to the other witnesses who testified of similar conduct in the home by Mr. Cada.
Thank you, Mr. Braun. You will have an opportunity for rebuttal.
You, Your Honor.
Counsel for respondent, you may identify yourself and your client, and then you may present your argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. Kurt Kniezel, Kniezel, on behalf of respondent Brian Cada. May it please the court and counsel. I had some prepared statements to make here today. But quite honestly, I think I'm going to kind of abandon those because I think the court has really picked up on the real issues in this case, as I expected would occur. Really, what we need to focus on is the fact that there was 7 days of trial here. There were 10 witnesses that testified, somewhere in the neighborhood of 30 hours of testimony, producing 1,600 pages of transcript. All of that was considered by the district court, in addition to argument that was submitted following the evidentiary hearing and prior to the court's decision. I do want to clear up one aspect of that, and I think Mr. Braun has misrepresented the truth here. He indicates that the district court simply signed off on my findings and adopted them in their totality. That's patently untrue. If you have an opportunity to review the file, you'll see that the proposed findings that I submitted were in excess of 65 pages. The district court's order here is 13 pages of findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order. That's not adopting my proposed findings in any respect. So that's a misrepresentation. I just wanted to clear that up. In any event, after having the opportunity to hear all of that testimony, to see the exhibits, and to consider the arguments of counsel, the district court reached a conclusion. And frankly, that conclusion was accurate and shouldn't be disturbed by this court. Each of the arguments made by appellant are easily dismissed when we apply the correct standards of review and view the decision through the lens of the totality of the law in the state of Minnesota, as well as the basic tenets of common sense.
Mr. Knussel, and forgive me if I did I mispronounce your name?
It's Kniezel, but that's okay.
Kniezel. Okay. Let me focus for the minute for a minute on so in light of the evidence of bruising, which came in, I think, through a county social worker and otherwise, why is the district court's findings in paragraph 40 about no physical harm, no injury? Why are those findings not clearly erroneous?
Your Honor, I think that the issue is not whether there was bruising. And Mr. Braun, I think, creates a link there that was not established at trial. There is no dispute that the photos that were submitted showed bruising. There is questions regarding the credibility of those photos. Some of them, especially the more graphic of those, were provided by petitioner. And in any event, the injuries were not consistent with the type of injury that one would expect to receive from being spanked by a back scratcher. There's discussion in the transcript.
Can you be more specific about that? Why not consistent?
There's testimony given in the transcript that addresses something called a saddle injury. And a saddle injury occurs when a child is perhaps riding a bike and falls and the bar of the bike hits them immediately between their legs. There were injuries that were consistent with that and clearly not the result of being struck with a back scratcher. I think that's in part why the court did not find that to be credible. And in any event, after considering all the evidence, the court did specifically find that there was no real proof of physical or mental harm, and that there was no reliable evidence of injury from corporal punishment. So again, the district court has the purview of examining all that evidence and determining whether it is credible. And in this case, Judge Beitendorp found that information in conjunction with all the other information that was provided to her to be not credible. So I think it's a stretch for Mr. Braun to suggest that it's undisputed that these bruises occurred as a result of what Mr. Cada did, because that's simply not true. Mr. Cada provided a version of events where he did not administer any corporal punishment on the weekend in question. And when he had administered corporal punishment in the past, he had done so judiciously and reasonably. And the district court found his testimony to be credible, contrary to the petitioner and all of her supporting witnesses, which the district court specifically found to be incredible. The district court also had the benefit of hearing and seeing the demeanor of all the witnesses and reached a conclusion that there was concerns here, that the petitioner had influenced the witnesses, had, I think the quote was, done her utmost to sway them to her view, to her side of this argument. And I would suggest that that was very obvious during this trial. These children were in the sole custody of petitioner for a very long time. They live in a kind of a cloistered environment where they don't have a lot of exposure to the outside world. And it was evident that petitioner had influenced these children inappropriately. But I want to get to the argument that Mr. Braun makes here regarding the statutes. I think that can really be boiled down in his brief to one sentence. The sentence that he includes on page 25 of his principal brief, following the quote of the statutory language, Mr. Braun states that it's his opinion that there is no consideration of motive or rationale at all. If the alleged perpetrator inflicts physical injury or bodily harm on a fellow family member or household member, they have committed domestic abuse regardless of context. Now, what does that mean? Regardless of context, what would the result of such a finding be? What kind of precedent would that set? It doesn't take a great deal of imagination to understand why that would create an absurd result. In our brief, I posited a couple examples as to why that would be problematic. I talked about a parent assisting a child with removing a loose tooth or assisting a teen with popping a pimple. Both of those cause pain, which arguably is physical harm, and potentially physical injury to a person's body. But that's not domestic abuse. It's not domestic abuse any more than a parent administering a diabetic child an insulin shot or assisting a child with having their ears pierced. But in Mr. Braun and the appellant's world here, in the regardless of context world, both of those would be considered domestic abuse. That simply can't be the case. And I don't think that this court is going to be willing to make that time that kind of a stretch. I did talk in my brief about Mr. Braun's assertion that that Judge Beitendorp inappropriately relied upon the 60906 authorization for reasonable use of force, and his argument that there's no specific exemption carved out of the domestic abuse statute. I don't think that the legislature can carve out an exception for every single thing that might possibly happen, but common sense and statutory interpretation, the basic tenets of statutory interpretation, allow for both statutes to exist in conjunction. What Mr. Braun is suggesting is that they can't. When one reviews these two statutes using the directive of Minnesota Statute Section 645.26, Subdivision 1, which provides that when a general provision in a law is in conflict with a special provision in the same or another law, the two shall be construed, if possible, so that effect may be given to both. When we do that with both of these two statutes, the analysis is very simple. If reasonable force is authorized under Minnesota Statute Section 60906 and is exempted from the definition of domestic abuse, both statutes' effect remains uncompromised. 518B continues to provide relief to those who are victims of true domestic abuse, while 60906 continues to authorize parents to use reasonable force to discipline their children. Any other interpretation, including Mr. Braun's interpretation, compromise one or both of the statutes. If there's no exemption carved out of the definition of domestic abuse in 518 for reasonable discipline, then 60906 ceases to have any effect. Because in that case, anytime a parent asserted that right to use reasonable force to impose discipline, the child would automatically have grounds for an order for protection. It would de facto prohibit that behavior. That simply is not the case, and is not in accordance with the intent of the legislature in enacting those statutes, and that's just obvious. The court has already addressed in a great deal of the credibility issues in this case. The lion's share of Mr. Braun's arguments here rely upon him trying to convince you that Judge Beitendorf did not accurately assess the credibility of the witnesses in this case and the evidence. There's ample case law outlined in my brief, as well as anywhere else, that's not the purview of this court. And you've already kind of picked up on that in your questions to Mr. Braun, but you know what Mr. Braun is asking you to do is not something that this court is authorized to do.
Mr. Kniesel,
Sure.
did the district court make any credibility findings as to Mr. Bugs or Ms. Braun?
I think you mean Mr. Bugs or
Sorry, yeah.
Ms. Bauer.
Yes. Yes, thank you.
So with regard to Mr. Bugs, they didn't the I would suggest that Mr. Braun has, first of all, represented Mr. Bugs' testimony. I don't believe that I recall Mr. Bugs rendering any sort of an opinion as to whether abuse had occurred or whether the discipline had actually been unreasonable. The district court did not address very closely Mr. Bugs' testimony because, quite honestly, I think if you review the testimony of Mr. Bugs, it didn't really offer a lot to the analysis. He acknowledged that he hadn't really spent a considerable amount of time with these children. He hadn't viewed them with their parents. His role, as he saw it, was just simply to determine what he thought was appropriate as far as parenting time, which he did allow for parenting time with all of the children. If there had been domestic abuse, I would expect that he would not have. With regard to Ms. Bauer, I think the court did make a specific finding. The court, and if you give me a moment here, I can try and point to the exact finding, but the court found here in finding 41, the second sentence, the Department of Human Services found possible maltreatment, but the investigation was incomplete. And so I would suggest that that is, in fact, an observation with regard to her credibility. If she's not completed in a com if she's not conducted a complete investigation, her conclusions as a result of that investigation are necessarily also incomplete, therefore not credible. I can also point out that, for what it's worth, in Mr. Braun's brief, he suggests that the testimony and the evidence was that the DHS determination had not been appealed. That's not accurate. If you look in the evidence, you will see that Mr. Cada testified that he did, in fact, appeal the decision. And since I was present at the appeal hearing, I know for a fact that it was appealed because we're still waiting for a decision on that. So I think that was inaccurate as well. In the end,
Mr. Kniezel, before you move on, can I go back to your reference to paragraph 41 about the investigation being incomplete? That the district court referred to that as a DHS, Department of Human Services determination, and an investigator. Was the investigator in that case Ms. Bauer? I thought Ms. Bauer was a county employee. Was she investigating for purposes of DHS as well as the county's own investigation?
Sure. So,
I guess I'm assuming this is State Department of Human Services, but I'm not certain about that.
right, and that's where the issue lies. I think Ms. Bauer is an employee of Winona County, but she works in the Department of Human Services, the county level Department of Human Services or CPS. So that is a county employee who would conduct that investigation when there's an allegation of maltreatment or neglect. So she
So
is the county employee.
the investigator referenced in paragraph 41 is Ms. Bauer.
That is correct.
Okay, thank you.
So in the end, I think, you know what really doesn't come out in the transcript and in the arguments and the briefs is just the totality of the evidence regarding the credibility of all of these witnesses. And I think that Judge Beitendorp did an excellent job of wading through that. In the end, she determined that she had two stories before her. One, this campaign of terror that petitioner claimed had been waged against her family for years, and another from Mr. Cada indicating that he was just a loving father who at times used judiciously administered reasonable corporal punishment. The court determined, based on all the evidence before her, that any discipline that had been administered by respondent was in fact judicious and reasonable, and determined that the allegations of the petitioner were not credible, her witnesses were not credible, and reached the correct decision here. This court should not disrupt that conclusion. We'd ask you to affirm the decision of the district court.
Thank you, Mr. Kniezel. Mr. Braun, you have an opportunity for rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Your Honor. What this really comes down to, Your Honors, is that we have a father who has acknowledged that he administers corporal punishment with a back scratcher. And you have children who talk about being in fear of their dad, which comports with the Domestic Violence Act and justifies a finding against their father. And what the court did in its findings was really just ignore evidence that was before it. Audrey Bauer's investigation was complete. I mean, there's an exhibit, the October 16th, 2023 letter. Her investigation was finalized and done and wrapped up, and she was questioned about the extent of her investigation and who she talked to and who she didn't. So for the court to then say that the investigation was incomplete, it was complete pursuant to Minnesota law and under statute, and a finding was made, and really just ignored by the court. Similarly, Mr. Bugs's report ignored by the court because it doesn't comport with the court's ultimate finding that there was not evidence of domestic abuse. And this notion that the saddle injury is the justification for the youngest child's, demonstrated bruising. He had 8 to 9 bruises on his buttocks. That is not consistent with a child falling onto his bike. And that theory, that saddle injury, was investigated by Winona County Human Services and dispelled as a cause of harm. And in fact, it was Mr. Cada who they concluded caused that harm. And the court's findings do not square those issues, those previous determinations that apparently are still under appeal. But it's that physical evidence that's present in this case that the court cannot use credibility determinations to disturb, so it's just wholly ignored.
Mr. Braun, so if the district court ignored certain evidence, or perhaps, I mean, wasn't it your obligation to file a motion for amended findings in order to to prompt the district court to consider that evidence and to, you know, and to incorporate it into the order. And in the absence of that, and again, I think you're not, I think your brief does not say, does not argue that any findings are clearly erroneous. But so I'm just wondering what we can do on this appeal, in light of both, in light of the district court's findings and conclusions.
So, we considered filing a motion for amended findings, and but really it would be a restatement of the argument that we already made before the court. So, this we did not want to make that into a motion for reconsideration because, this was briefed ad nauseum. The court heard a significant amount of evidence. It's clear to me from the tone of the court's order with respect to the credibility determinations. That the court felt justified in making its determination here. So I think the direct appeal of those issues was appropriate under the circumstances. I also think that it's appropriate for the court to look at the district court's use of the discipline statute in analyzing whether that was a proper use and justification of that statutory provision. When you have a case where there's spanking, that acknowledges the use of corporal punishment. You've got bruising on the child after his parenting time. You've got Macy talking about him being the respondent, bringing the youngest child into his room and hearing screaming from that child. And there's bruising present days later. That analysis is completely devoid in the court's findings. It's just absent. And it's because the court cannot square those facts with the credibility determinations ultimately that it had to reach to justify its opinion. So you can't just set aside the corroborating evidence and ignore, the actual proof in the case in order to justify the ultimate opinion to dismiss the order for protection. And I just have to say, if this case were to stand, the precedents that this would set, that it's okay for a father to use a back scratcher or some other instrumentality to punish his children. And he acknowledges that openly in his testimony, that that's okay in the state of Minnesota, I believe is inconsistent with common sense, the law of the state of Minnesota, and the direction that this court, should give parents in parenting their children. Thank you.
I want to follow up on your last point. I think Judge Smith earlier asked you if it would be different if he used his hand, not the back scratcher. I mean, and I just, is there anything in the statute or the case law that makes a distinction between using one's hand versus, you know, some object?
I'm not aware of any case law which creates a distinction between using an object to discipline a child and or a hand. There is case law which talks about a spanking from a belt that resulted in a bruising was justifiable for an order for protection. That case is cited in our brief. But if an individual uses a weapon to strike another, it's second degree assault. So, I mean, we have to view this in the context of what these children are feeling and the fear that comes with dad carrying this instrumentality of abuse around the house and, by his own acknowledgement, using it against his own children.
I have one more question, and that is, and I so your reference just now to fear implicates paragraph two of the definition of domestic abuse. I guess in preparation for this argument, I was not focusing on fear. I did not. I assumed you were relying on paragraph one, which is based on physical harm, bodily injury, or assault. And I thought that's the way the case was presented, both below and in the briefing. Am I in? Can we focus only on paragraph one, or are you now urging us to make our analysis broader than that?
Thank you, Your Honor. That's a great question. I think it's got to be broader than that because in the guardian ad litem report, Mr. Bugs talks about all of the children except for the oldest having fear of their father, and that fear is in large part because of the corporal punishment that has been previously administered, and that was his intention. That's why he carried this back scratcher around the house, was to get compliance with these children at bedtime. So, because if they didn't comply, they were going to get hit. So I think fear is a major component of it.
I don't recall seeing any findings by the district court about fear or lack of fear. Was that argued to the district court? And for example, did you submit proposed findings that covered the fear issue, paragraph two?
Yeah, it was argued to the court. It was presented to the court in the ex parte motion as the children having fear, and it was present through the testimony and also argued to the court at our proposed findings.
If there are no further questions from other panel members, it appears there are none, then the case is submitted. The court will issue its written opinion within 90 days in writing, always released on the internet at 10 a.m. on Mondays. Thank you to both counsel for your arguments, and the case is submitted. Thank you.
Thank you.